this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline across the top of the page, Bass Pro Shops Angles for Outdoor Bucks. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Cary. Crews have been busy shifting around boats and other gear for the new Bass Pro Shop Sportsman Center, opening to the public on February 12. For Anita Bumgarner, the store's new general manager, it's coming home. Bumgarner, who transferred from the Bass Pro Shop store in Denham Springs, Louisiana, grew up in North Wilkesboro and still has family in North Carolina. It's exciting to be back in this area after many, many years, she says. And for a while, Bumgarner and Missouri-based Bass Pro Shops will be the big kid on the block when it comes to outdoor retail in the Triangle. The new 105,000-square-foot store on Harrison Avenue in Cary will be stocked with hundreds of options in outdoor apparel, equipment parts, and supplies for all sorts of hunting, camping, fishing, boating, and marine activities. In a nod to North Carolina heritage, it will have a hand-painted mural of the Outer Banks, aquarium stocked with local fish, an indoor archery range, and trophy mounts from hunters statewide. Its grand opening celebration will include appearances by North Carolina NASCAR team owner Richard Childress, former Carolina Panthers tight end Wesley Walls, former Bassmaster Angler of the Year and TV host Timmy Horton, and others, along with Bass Pro Shop's founder, Johnny Morris. However, just about every other major outdoor retail brand in the U.S. has also set their sights on expansion into the Triangle over the past few months as well. Outdoor recreation in North Carolina already supports 191,500 jobs and contributes more than $19 billion in consumer spending annually, according to data from the Outdoor Industry Association, and those numbers have caught the attention of retailers. Cabela's, the other big national big-box outdoor retailer, along with Gander Mountain and the new Field & Stream store lineup that Dick's Sporting Goods is spinning out, have also announced new stores opening in the region in 2014 and early 2015. Cabela's is expected to start construction of its first store in North Carolina at a site in Garner in June with an anticipated opening in spring 2015. The Cabela store will be about the same size as the Bass Pro Shop store with 100,000 square feet. Gander Mountain opened its first store in the region in Morrisville in 2012 and announced plans in November to open a second 50,000 square foot store on Capitol Boulevard in North Raleigh. The new Raleigh store is expected to open in mid-May. Field & Stream in January was seeking construction subcontractors and suppliers for a new store planned at the Parkside Town Common Shopping Center in Cary, but the company has yet to make a formal announcement providing further details about the new store. Altogether, these outdoor retailers will be creating close to 700 new full and part-time jobs and will occupy more than 350,000 square feet of retail floor space. Bumgarner says the Bass Pro Shops in Cary will create about 200 jobs when it is fully ramped up and that most of the positions have been filled. And just below that article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, we have the cover story. And the cover story starting here is a very large picture of Bill Roper. The headline, What's on Bill Roper's Mind? And the caption for the large picture of Bill Roper is, Navigating the tempestuous seas of the healthcare industry is all in a day's work for UNC Healthcare CEO Dr. William Bill Roper. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun. And then after that introduction, the actual story is on the inside of the Triangle Business Journal with another headline that says, What keeps Bill Roper up at night? CEO and med school dean weighs in on healthcare industry's hottest issues. It's no surprise that Dr. William Bill Roper admits that sometimes he's stressed. After all, he leads one of the state's largest healthcare systems, UNC Healthcare, at a time when there has arguably been more focus on healthcare spending than ever before. He's also dean of the UNC School of Medicine in Chapel Hill, which sometimes requires subsidies from hospital operations. At a time of reduced reimbursements from government payers like Medicare and Medicaid, tougher negotiations from private payers like Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, and state cuts to the university system and federal cuts to research. When asked if his job is stressful, he concedes, "I admit that it is." Still, he says he can't imagine doing one of those jobs without doing both of them, positions he's now held for 10 years. Despite all the collegiality and friendly discussion, there are times when I have to say to one part of the organization, "You have to send money to this part of the organization," Roper says. Without a single position to oversee both ventures, Roper says budget discussions would turn into turf wars. His role also includes mediating sometimes conflicting issues of health policy. The business of healthcare in the U.S. is not for the weak in spirit. In the past year, the healthcare sector has seen its highest ever CEO turnover. Management of a major healthcare system comes with a regular onslaught of input and pressure from legislators, policymakers, insurers, providers, taxpayers, and patients. It's enough to keep even the savviest CEO up at night. A tsunami in the making. As healthcare costs become a larger part of the American consciousness, Roper says hospital systems will have to adapt. "I believe the issue most important for healthcare for the coming decade is going to be it costs too much. And the American people are in the process of deciding we don't want to pay this much," he says. Roper compares the healthcare debate to the cultural role of smoking in the U.S. In the late 1970s, Americans decided smoking was no longer socially attractive. Cigarettes were banned from airplanes, schools, hospitals, and eventually even bars and restaurants. "I believe that in the coming decade, we are going to see fundamental changes about the American public's willingness to pay so much for healthcare," Roper says. "And we that are in the business have got to do our best to deal with that. It's like a tsunami coming to shore." Americans spend more for procedures than any other nation, sometimes by a wide margin, as treatment has become decoupled from payment. After World War II, when the federal government instituted wage laws, companies competed for workers with tax-free fringe benefits, including employer-based health care, which insulated workers from health care costs. Stan Taylor, Vice President for Corporate Planning at WakeMed Health and Hospitals, points out that as patients changed how they paid for health care, hospitals no longer needed to compete on price, so they competed on amenities, which contributed to inflated costs. In the past decade, however, insurance companies have shifted to what are called consumer-driven plans, shifting payment responsibility, particularly the first dollars, to patients. More plans now cover the major procedures, but not until the patient first pays a higher deductible. Health insurers and employers have largely supported these high-deductible plans or plans with health savings accounts. In fact, the most recent census from America's Health Insurance Plans, the trade association that represents the health insurance industry, found that these plans now account for the greatest enrollment increases in the large group market. Health savings plans encourage individuals to take an active role in their healthcare decisions while stretching their healthcare dollars, says Karen Inagni, AHIP president and CEO. A Kaiser Family Foundation survey found that in 2013, 78% of covered workers faced a general annual deductible, up from 73% the prior year. Last year, 58% of covered workers and small firms faced deductibles of at least $1,000, including nearly a third who faced deductibles of $2,000, up from 12% as recently as 2008. Premiums have also gone up. The same Kaiser survey reported that premiums have increased 80% since 2003, nearly three times as fast as both wages and inflation. Although these plans put a higher onus on patients to pay bills, it also makes patients more aware of the actual costs, which encourages hospitals to compete on price. Of course, Roper says this has had the effect of turning patients' ire toward hospitals. "We are living with the aftermath," he says. "People come to us and pull out their card, believing that this is going to pay for it because that's what health insurance does, right? But it doesn't really do that anymore. Ultimately, we need to have a serious conversation with the American public about what do you want from healthcare and how are you going to pay for it." Additional challenges. Reduced inpatient stays brought about by the Affordable Care Act are another challenge. For years, hospitals generated a significant portion of their revenue from these stays, which are marked by a patient staying longer than 24 hours. But they also contributed to escalating costs because medical advances have allowed procedures to be moved to the cheaper outpatient setting. Wearing his health policy hat, Roper says the move toward more outpatient procedures makes sense. Wearing his hospital CEO hat, however, he says it puts downward pressure on hospital revenues. Large hospital systems like the soon-to-be $3 billion UNC Healthcare also face a threat from specialty surgery centers as the Affordable Care Act and private payers continue to encourage patients to comparison shop. These clinics can offer common procedures at reduced prices without the overhead of a full hospital. In response, UNC will soon open a new hospital in Hillsboro. While only 9 miles from the mothership in Chapel Hill, it will primarily serve as a hospital for routine procedures. Medicaid privatization. A hot topic in recent North Carolina health policy discussions is Medicaid reform and how the state should spend the roughly $13 billion for health care for the state's poorest citizens. Early last year, Governor Pat McCrory and North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Aldana Woos floated an idea to contract with private organizations that would manage the Medicaid population. The state would pay a fixed amount to the private group, which would pay Medicaid claims and keep the remainder as profit. This would give the state a more predictable budget and put responsibility and risk on the private entity. Critics decried this as a privatization of Medicaid and predicted that it would reduce access to service and leave the state's neediest without health care, ultimately driving them back to emergency rooms. Somewhat surprisingly, Roper says that he sees ways that plan could work to control costs and still provide adequate service to those who need it most. The notion of taking organizations that are integrated and are able to provide care and paying them a fixed amount and holding them accountable, that makes an awful lot of sense to me, he says. If done right, that's a good idea, he says, strongly emphasizing the if. If not, however, Roper sees continued problems with the Medicaid program. Roper has not always aligned himself with McCrory's policies. In fact, he has and still does strongly advocate that the state expand the Medicaid program. Mental health system is screwed up. On May 22, 2012, UNC Healthcare agreed to invest $40 million on mental health in Wake County and to take over operation of Wakebrook, a mental and behavioral health hospital in close proximity to Holly Hill Hospital and WakeMed. Bill Atkinson, then the head of WakeMed, had argued that UNC did not carry its weight in terms of caring for the mentally ill population and that WakeMed was bearing more of that burden. Since opening and expanding the Wakebrook facility last year, the hospital has been running at capacity, and still more care is needed as patients with mental illnesses clog hospital emergency rooms. Mental health care in our society and in North Carolina is screwed up, Roper says. I want to use an elegant term, but it's just really, really a problem. As with rising health care prices, today's problems stem from decisions made years ago. The landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision in Wyatt v. Stickney set the stage of deinstitutionalizing mental health patients. Experts today agree that care in these institutions was too close to that depicted in the film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest than anyone would like to admit. But it was a short-sighted policy to simply place these patients in communities that did not have the necessary infrastructure in place to care for them. We are paying a gigantic price as a society because we just haven't gotten this right, Roper says. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services is in the process of working toward a revamp of mental health care under the leadership of Dave Richard, director of the North Carolina Division of Mental Health, and Roper says he pleads regularly with legislators to please do this right. And along with this cover story, there's also a section headlined UNC Health Project Updates. Hillsboro Hospital Medical Office Building. The Hillsboro Hospital and Medical Office Building are in the Waterstone development in Hillsboro. When completed, the site will have four main buildings: the main hospital, patient tower, medical office building, and central utility plant. The hospital building is approximately 270,000 square feet and includes 68 licensed acute care beds, 15 unlicensed observation beds, 6 operating rooms, including a Da Vinci robot, 2 general procedure rooms, 2 radiology procedure rooms in the surgical suite, emergency department, level 2, not a trauma center, and other traditional ancillaries and support services. The medical office building is about 60,000 square feet and includes various clinics and procedure rooms. December 2014, construction completion date for Hillsborough Hospital. July 1, 2013, construction completion date for the medical office building. $230 million, board-approved budget. $230 million, project final cost. Department of Insurance required exit corrections. Various building additions have resulted in conversion of exterior stairs into interior stairs and extended exit corridors. Although the hospital completed some ground floor corridor upgrades in 2005 per Department of Insurance approved plans, DOI raised some concerns about the safety of these egress paths. August 2014, construction completion date, $2.7 million, board-approved budget, $5.1 million, project final cost. Third floor bed tower renovations. This project completely renovates the third floor of the bed tower into a 24-bed medical progressive care unit. April 2014, construction completion date, $10 million, board-approved budget, and $10 million, project final cost. And now we turn to the biz column in the Triangle Business Journal, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, and the headline that starts it off, Every Little Thing He Does is Magic. Everyone remembers a brush with celebrity at some point in their lives. For Gary Joyner, who heads Kilpatrick Townsend's Triangle office, it was no different. Joyner tells Biz that he and his wife, Wendy, flew over to one of the most northerly of the Leeward Islands in the Caribbean, Anguilla, during the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend in January. So, here we are, minding our business at the gym, and who do we see? Magic Johnson, Joyner recalls, still with excitement some 3 weeks removed from the encounter. Magic was there celebrating his wife's birthday. Apparently, Johnson knows a lot about the Tar Heel State and, of course, the Tar Heels. The Joyner started talking with Johnson only to find out the legendary National Basketball League star spent summers in Rocky Mount during his teenage years. A slice of magic for Joyner on his holiday? Priceless. Molly Had a Little Lamb, her artist, won a prize. A scientist and an artist? Apparently, the two can coexist in one body. Biz learned that Sheila Young, a trainee with a PhD at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences in RTP, had her artwork featured in the 2014 AbCam Molly calendar. Contestants were invited to submit original artwork featuring the company's mascot, Molly, a fanciful molecular version of Dolly, the sheep cloned in 1989 in Cambridge, UK, where AbCam was founded in 1998. Young's piece, titled Molly's Lamb's First Day at School, is the September calendar page. Governor Haley drops in for a schools visit. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley recently visited both Franklin Academy and Thales Academy in Wake Forest to tour the schools and observe key components of their curricula that she intends to implement as part of an education reform proposal in her own state. Governor Haley is specifically focusing on improving the educational experience in poorer school districts by increasing access to technology in classrooms while offering more support for teachers, things she believes both Franklin and Thales have accomplished. Bob Luddy, the founder of the schools as well as the CEO of Raleigh-based Captive Air Systems, served as Governor Haley's tour guide. During the visit, Luddy introduced Governor Haley to some of the foundational aspects of the schools, including direct instruction, a research-based teaching method, dress code, and an emphasis on character development. Where all the lights are bright, downtown. York Properties' Smeedy's York is taking the long way home, straight through downtown Raleigh. That's according to a speech he gave at last week's TBJ Real Estate Awards, announcing Pillar Award winner Greg Haddam of Empire Properties. York says he actually caught himself saying, "Let's drive through downtown Raleigh." And that's a big deal because 10 or 15 years ago, he thought differently. "I would have said, there's an easier way," he said. "The big change is what's happening in our central cities." First Tees Gala will feature LPGA legend. Want to hobnob with someone who shot a 59 in an official golf tournament? No, it is not Tiger Woods. He has never done it, actually. It's Annika Sorenstam, the legendary LPGA Tour player who has 72 victories, including 10 major golf championships. Sorenstam is coming to the Triangle on September 20 to celebrate the first tee of the Triangle's 20th gala at the Carolina Country Club. She not only serves as a role model for the children at the first tee, but she also embodies and believes in our core values, says Brandon Baker, the organization's executive director. Biz would like to challenge Sorenstam if she is going to play a round when in town. Of course, she has to spot at least one shot a hole to make it fair. Hey, we can raise some money for the charity as well. Contributing to Biz were staffers Jason DeBrun, Cameron Snipes, Jesse Burkhart, and Lauren Onsorge. And returning to our full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal, the next article has the headline, RTP's new plan focuses on urbanization of park. And this article is written by Lauren Onsorge with the dateline of Research Triangle Park. A standing room only crowd heard a bullish claim at the Research Triangle Foundation on February 3, a 100-acre expansion that could mean 100,000 new jobs for the world-famous office park. But the story is bigger than a number, says the guy making the claims, Research Triangle Foundation CEO Bob Giolis. He says it's about the park's survival. The park, shaped on the business of early industry mammoths such as IBM, GlaxoSmithKline, and Cisco, is dying. Companies and the young professionals they're trying to attract no longer want the isolated campuses that caught Big Blue's eye decades ago, he says. They're looking for urbanization, retail, and restaurants, reasons for IBMers to venture outside their offices on their lunch hour. Without an urbanization infusion, Research Triangle Park, what Giolis calls the region's economic driver, will stop driving. And that's what Giolis invited a crowd to his. That's why Giolis invited a crowd to his big announcement that the first phase of the park's redevelopment would happen at the newly acquired Park Center. It's part of nearly 100 acres near I-40, acquired for $17 million, parcels that include the old Governor's Inn property and a to-be-relocated Research Triangle High School. But the price tag isn't just the land cost. Giolis says his vision will require $2 billion in private investments necessary to bring in the retail and residential features the term urbanization requires. And while board member and developer Smeedy's York says there's been tremendous interest, no one has yet signed a check for the effort. That's where Giolis's pitch comes in. With RTP making a concrete $17 million commitment, it's time for the public and private sectors to match that effort, both with their wallets and with their lobbying. "This is no longer something we're just talking about," Giolis says. While the infrastructure already in place at Park Center will move the renovation timeline up a year, a lot still has to happen, including the completion of that often talked about rail line, and that requires public support, he says. And while 1,000 jobs an acre is a bullish projection, Catherine Thomas, former president of the North Carolina Economic Development Association and current market president of Alfred Williams, says it's realistic. "The tract would provide enough space for 6 million square feet under roof," she says, "so it's a projection based on that amount of square footage, and yes, it's my understanding that it would accommodate the potential for that many jobs." "That can only happen if the public steps up," Giolis says, "and the universities have their own parts to play." We have been involved with and partnered in Research Triangle Park really since its creation, says Tom Ross, an RTF board member and president of the University of Carolina system. It is part of the beauty of Research Triangle Park. What's made it so successful for North Carolina has been the partnership between the private sector and the public sector. Researchers are already collaborating with RTP businesses and with more firms in the park that will organically increase. But a real point of excitement is what Giolis calls a convergence center, a yet-to-be-conceived building that he envisions housing both researchers and the public, similarly to the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences Nature Research Center. But he's taking the collaborative center up a notch, envisioning a signature landmark, a research space that doubles as a venue for the likes of TED Talks and even concerts. He's confident that in the same way citizens rallied in the 1950s to transform farmland into an industrial park, today's Triangle will rally to bring its park into the 21st century. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to A Better World, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And we start with the column written by Todd Cohen. The headline, Durham Congregations Band Together to Serve the Homeless. When the Durham Interfaith Hospitality Network opened on January 8, 1994, the only emergency shelters in the community forced homeless families to split up, with fathers needing to stay in separate shelters from the ones their families stayed in. There was really no emergency shelter in Durham for families that would keep families together, says Catherine Pleel, executive director of DIHN. Looking for a way to keep homeless families whole, an interfaith group known as Durham Congregations in Action looked at strategies throughout the U.S. and found a national model in a group of congregations in Summit, New Jersey, that took turns providing emergency shelter. The result was DIHN, which now consists of more than 30 congregations. Over the past 20 years, it has provided more than 40,000 nights of shelter and more than 100,000 meals to roughly 265 families. Now, the agency is looking for ways to help homeless families get back on their feet by providing transitional housing, expanding support services it provides to better serve clients with mental health challenges, and better involving its more than 800 volunteers in its work. Three families at any given time stay for up to 3 months in emergency housing provided by 12 host congregations, with the other congregations providing food and other assistance. Families rotate among congregations, staying from Sunday night through Saturday night at one congregation before moving to another for a week. Each congregation provides a separate room for each family in a classroom, office, or other available space. Within those 3 months, DIHN tries to help each family find jobs and permanent housing. Faced with a long waiting list, Pleel says DIHN in December 2012 began renting a house that has space for two additional families and provides space for a third family in the house it owns that serves as its headquarters. DIHN also provides support services, such as helping families find daycare, arrange for a bus from the Durham Public Schools to pick up their children, and find jobs. It also partners with other agencies to help its clients create resumes and prepare for job interviews and the world of work. And in 2010, with a grant from Durham County, it added a program that provides support services for 24 families for a year after they leave the emergency housing its member congregations provide. DIHN, which operates with an annual budget of about $250,000 and a staff of three people, generates revenue from congregations, events, individuals, corporations, and government, which now accounts for 30% of its revenue, down from 40% in 2011. The agency is studying the feasibility of providing families with stationary housing rather than having them rotate among congregations, providing more support for clients with mental illness and more stability for children, and engaging volunteers in ways that make better use of their skills. The goal, Pleel says, is to find a different service model that would serve our clients even better and engage our volunteers in a way that would be better for our guests and more fulfilling to volunteers. And in nonprofit news, Durham's Partnership for Children, a Smart Start initiative, will host an early childhood bus tour to give community leaders information about how Durham County's youngest children and families are receiving services that promote healthy development and learning. The tour will be held February 11 from 8:30 a.m. to 11:30 a.m., and anyone is invited to join. It will begin at the partnership's office with coffee and a brief volunteer activity to benefit young children. The tour will then leave for visits to El Centro Hispano, White Rock Child Development Center, and Welcome Baby, where participants will observe early learning experiences for children birth to five and their families. Those interested should RSVP to Chrissy Dunn at 919-403-6960 or Chrissy, K-R-I-S-S-Y, at dpfc.net. Jimmy V's Osteria and Bar has raised more than $27,000 for cancer research since opening on September 24. The restaurant, which is next door to the Sheraton Raleigh Hotel, donates 2.5% of its revenue to the V Foundation, which makes cancer research grants, and is named for the late Jim Valvano, former NC State Wolfpack basketball coach and ESPN commentator. And in People on the Move, the First Tee of the Triangle hired Doug Sampson as a senior program director and Cara Fishburne as a program coordinator. Together, they replaced Brandon Baker, who was promoted to executive director in October 2013. And Virginia Parker joined the United Way of the Greater Triangle as a senior vice president and leader of its resource development department. She focuses on expanding workplace relationships and engagement and developing major gifts, grants, and partnerships to support UWGT's community impact initiatives. And now we turn to the reporter pages, and we start with the page of Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. And the first story is in a section called Deal of the Week. The headline, A Power Move in Downtown Raleigh, Powerhouse Square Buildings Selling to York Joint Venture. The historic Powerhouse Square block of buildings in downtown Raleigh could, for the first time in a long time, be sold to a partnership group that doesn't involve the local power company. The Powerhouse Square Joint Venture between what is now Duke Energy and Cary developer Greg Sandruder have contracted to sell the complex's three office, retail, and restaurant buildings, plus the parking deck across the street, according to several real estate sources. The prospective buyer is a joint venture between York Properties of Raleigh and Shiner Capital Partners of Chicago. A proposed purchase price has not been disclosed, but the properties have a combined tax value of almost $17 million. The buildings were formerly a garage and storage facility for Carolina Power and Light, a predecessor company to Progress Energy, which invested millions into the buildings in 1998 to convert them into offices and restaurant space. Raleigh architect firm Klein Design anchors the office space. Natty Green's Pub and Brewery occupies the 505 West Jones Street building. The Indian cuisine restaurant Mantra occupies another. And a new restaurant and bar called Storm Clouds Brewing will be opening this summer in the former Napper Dandy's restaurant space on West Street. And in the section marked New Retail, Morrisville Retail Center snags four new stores. The owners of the Park West Village Retail Center in Morrisville have signed up four new retail and restaurant tenants for the Power Center, including the market's newest location for organic health foods grocer, Earth Fair. Fletcher-based Earth Fair opened its first grocery store in the Triangle in 2005 at the Briardale at Briar Creek Shopping Center in Northwest Raleigh. But the company has waited 8 years to commit to opening a second location in the region, while its competitors, including the Fresh Market, Trader Joe's, and Whole Foods, have added multiple new store locations in that time. The new Earth Fair at Park West Village will occupy a new 25,000-square-foot building at the corner of Morrisville Parkway and Chapel Hill Road, says Shannon Dixon, executive vice president in charge of Southeast Operations for Park West Village owner Casto. Joining Earth Fair at Park West Village will be A Pier 1 Imports furniture and home decor store that will open this summer in 10,000 square feet next to Alta and Gander Mountain. A Blackfin Ameripub full-service restaurant in 6,000 square feet near the Park West Village 14 movie theater. A Charming Charlie fashion accessories and jewelry store in 6,000 square feet next to Alta. Both Charming Charlie and Alta are expected to open in early February. And in another section called Property Matters, the Church and Main condos have broken ground in Durham. The developers of the planned Church and Main condominium building in downtown Durham have officially broken ground and started construction. Church and Main is slated to have 8 condo units in the 5-story modern-style building next to the Durham County Administration Building and the Church Street parking deck. Church and Main is a joint venture of Revamp Durham and White Oak Properties of Raleigh. Center Studio Architecture is the designer of the project, and the Davidson & Jones Construction Company is the general contractor. Retail Merchants Group is moving to downtown Raleigh. The headquarters office for the North Carolina Retail Merchants Association will soon be moving into the heart of the Raleigh downtown district. The association has bought the 2-story office building at 209 Fayetteville Street, the former home office for the Therrington Smith Law Firm, for $3.5 million, according to county deed records. The law firm has moved its office to the Wells Fargo Capital Center Tower. The association staff, along with its workers' compensation insurance affiliate, First Benefits Insurance Mutual, will be moving to the downtown building in late spring or early summer after renovations are complete. And the estates at Wake Forest Community sold for $37.2 million. The newly constructed apartment community estates at Wake Forest has already sold to a new investor group for $37.2 million. Trade Street Residential of Aventura, Florida, acquired the 288-unit community near Caveness Farms and US 1 from Woodfield Investments of Arlington, Virginia. The garden-style apartment project had opened in September. Its rents range from $800 to $1,475 per month. And finally, there's a note in the residential market section. Market shows muted gains for triangle house flippers. The buy low, sell high investment strategy for house flipping, or homes purchased and sold again within 6 months, is starting to gain strength again nationally, but it is showing muted gains for triangle sellers. And now we turn to the page of reporter Jason DeBrun. DeBrun covers healthcare, higher education, and biopharma. In the pharmaceutical section, the headline, Triangle Pharma's Eye, New Drug Development. Drug development is big business in the Triangle, and this week a few companies reported good progress on various drugs they are developing. Not included in the press releases, however, are the specifics of the deals these companies strike with other drug companies, either to license, develop, or market the new drugs. Listed below are the 2 announcements from this past week, but with additional financial information about the prospective drug. Biogen IDEC. Biogen IDEC announced Monday that it received approval in the European Union to sell its oral multiple sclerosis pill, Tecfidera, spelled T-E-C-F-I-D-E-R-A, a drug that has been called a miracle pill and was developed partly here in Research Triangle Park. The story of Tecfidera for Biogen begins in 2006 when it acquired it and another drug, Fumiderm, when the company bought the Swiss drug maker Fumapharm AG. Biogen paid $220 million at closing and agreed to pay an additional $15 million if either of the products were approved for MS in the United States or European Union. The first such payment happened in the second quarter of 2013 when Tecfidera was approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. In addition, there are sales milestones that Biogen must pay depending on how well the drug sells. The formula is somewhat complex and combines both annual sales and cumulative sales. In its first year, Biogen recorded $876 million in sales, which, according to the formula, means it owes former Fumapharm shareholders $22 million. Payments increase incrementally based on sales. If annual sales top $3 billion, Biogen would owe Fumapharm $300 million. Furex Pharmaceuticals. Furex announced positive phase 3 trial results for eluxadoline, spelled E-L-U-X-A-D-O-L-I-N-E, the drug that has received most of the company's attention this past year. The announcement sent the stock soaring from close of $46 on February 3rd to a high of $122 on February 4. With the positive trial results, Furex is on track to submit a new drug application, NDA, with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration as soon as the second quarter of this year, a major accomplishment for any drug development company. On this drug, Furex has a partnership with Janssen, an affiliate of Johnson & Johnson. Depending on various milestones, Furex could owe Janssen up to $45 million during development and up to $75 million plus other royalties, depending on sales. And in the section Deal of the Week, Cary drug developer Cornerstone Therapeutics has officially gone private after Italy-based Chiesi Pharmaceutici acquired the remaining outstanding stock the company announced on Tuesday. Chiesi, which already owned 58% of Cornerstone stock, paid $9.50 for each share, a 78% premium on the closing price on February 15, 2013, the last trading day prior to Chiesi's written proposal. Cornerstone CEO Craig A. Collard owned 1.6 million shares, or about 6% of shares. In 2013, Chiesi recorded sales of more than 1.2 billion euros. The Chiesi Group employs approximately 3,900 people, 480 of which are dedicated to research and development. And in the final section, called By the Numbers, $3.1 trillion, the projected national health expenditures for 2014 as estimated by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, 18.3%, the portion of the U.S. gross domestic product that health spending will make up this year, $3.8 trillion, the estimated actual costs of healthcare spending this year after factoring in additional direct and indirect costs as estimated by Deloitte, which purports to include hidden costs of healthcare spending outside national health expenditure accounts, what CMS uses to estimate costs, and 10%, the percentage of healthcare costs in the United States spent on pharmaceuticals. And now we have the page of reporter Lauren Onsorge. Onsorge covers infotech and entrepreneurism. And in a section called Technology M&A, the headline, DigitalSmith's TiVo deal could add jobs. DigitalSmith's founders, Ben Weinberger and Matt Berry, say the news that their video technology firm is being acquired by TiVo for $135 million means more Durham jobs. Right now, DigitalSmith's has really created a position where we've closed most of the top-tier cable service providers in the United States, Barry says, adding that they expected outside interest after 2013. While he won't be specific, he confirms TiVo was not the only deal his team considered. What set TiVo apart was how it valued DigitalSmith's headcount. In the beginning, when we started the company, our investors were investing in the people, not just the idea of the business, he says. When we looked at TiVo as a potential acquirer relative to other companies, we felt they had a viewpoint on our culture and our people that we were aligned with. TiVo also plans to continue the local growth DigitalSmith's has pushed for since moving to the Research Triangle Park area in late 2006. TiVo is going to continue to invest in the region, and the intent is to generally keep the majority of the company, Weinberger explains. They want to keep the office here. They want to continue to invest in the region. And that means hiring. While it's too early to determine what synergies will be created after integration, the move is a good one for employees, he says, adding that the integration process will start immediately. TiVo CFO Naveen Chopra reiterates the message. We think the number one priority that we have going into this transaction is maintaining and expanding the momentum that Digital Smiths has created, and that can only be done by their team, he says. We need their team to execute. And another article has the headline, How Acquisitions Impact Local Firm Headcounts. Will TiVo value the 49-person employee roster as much as Digital Smiths founders Ben Weinberger and Matt Berry? For perspective, we looked at two previous deals that brought big payouts to startups in recent years, Raleigh's ShareFile and Morrisville's iContact. ShareFile. This Raleigh startup provided secure file transfer software and had about 85 employees on its payroll when it announced it was being acquired by Florida tech giant Citrix in 2011. The following June, Citrix announced it would be adding 337 jobs in Raleigh, each with an average wage of $70,914, and investing up to $26 million. The company chose a building in the Warehouse District, and renovation started last year on its new Raleigh Operations Center. At the time, ShareFile founder Jesse Lipson told me it was Citrix's emphasis on the people part of the equation that made him sign onto the acquisition deal. And Citrix seems to be keeping its end of the bargain. Lipson told me the firm is currently at about 425 employees. iContact. A startup darling from the Idea Fund Partners portfolio, this email marketing company had 250 employees when it was sold to Maryland-based Vocus for $169 million in 2012. At the time, iContact co-founder Ryan Allis told me the plan was to keep the people in place. Something that was really important to me was that we shared a common view over how we think about employees, customers, and the community, he told me then. A month later, 75 of those employees were axed, and Alice no longer on the payroll. As of late 2013, the firm had only 159 employees at its Morrisville operation. So how can Digital Smiths grow like ShareFile and avoid acquisition shrink like iContact? Choosing an acquirer that is focused on retaining your people and fits with your core values is critical. It's also important to align upfront on how the acquired company will be integrated or incubated after the acquisition, Lipson says. And in a section called Private Equity, the headline, Dude Solutions to invest $100 million in Carry Operation. A $100 million investment at Dude Solutions in Cary will triple the software firm's 220 employee headcount over 5 years, with 30 job openings immediately. Company founders Kent Hudson, CEO, and Lee Provost, President, tell us they plan on being Cary's next big economic injection. That's 440 new jobs for the company, founded in 1999. Dude Solutions, which provides cloud-based software that helps schools and other entities manage their information technology and energy consumption, is the parent company of both SchoolDude and FacilityDude. It secured $20 million in immediate investments from Warburg Pincus, a private equity firm based in New York. Hudson says the firm has agreed to front up to $100 million, with the initial $20 million going toward organic growth. Additional funds would be delivered should acquisition and other expansion opportunities emerge. We've been bootstrapped for about 15 years, Hudson says. The second quarter of last year, the executive team did a complete strategic reassessment of the company, and the conclusion of that was that we are doing good but not great, he says. We'd been growing in the mid to high teens and doing very good by a lot of people's standards, but when we looked at the market potential, the total addressable market, what new products we could build, what new services we could offer, we were basically ignoring a lot of opportunity that was available to us. In July, the team made the decision to capitalize, opting to contact private equity firms directly and not run the open process that's typical of capital-seeking companies. Warburg Pincus offered flexibility to draw additional capital if an acquisition target is located. It had been reaching out to School Dude for a year, so the interest was apparent, but Warburg wasn't the only option. "We've had very solid interest from venture capital and private equity for the past 8 years," Hudson says. "We've entertained those discussions and obviously have decided to stay bootstrapped until now." Warburg is now a minority player, he says, with Hudson and Provost retaining major equity. And in a by-the-number section, the headline, 2013 Smartphone Sales Rankings. With Lenovo's $2.9 billion buy of Google's mobility business, a smartphone shakeup is in order. The deal catapults Lenovo, which has a dual headquarters in Morrisville, to third place in smartphone sales globally. Here's the 2013 rankings from IDC for perspective. Samsung, 314 million smartphones shipped. Apple, 153 million smartphones shipped. Huawei, spelled H-U-A-W-E-I, 48.8 million smartphones shipped. LG, 47.7 million smartphones shipped. And Lenovo, 45.5 million smartphones shipped. And now we have the reporter page for Don Curry. Curry covers money and small business. The first section is called Made in the Triangle. The headline, Heirloom Provisions to Send North Carolina Goods Nationwide. In the coming weeks, people across the country can begin placing orders for North Carolina-made artisan products. Heirloom Provisions is a spin-off of Hillsboro-based Bella Beans Organics, which was acquired a few years ago by Richard Holcomb and Jamie DeMint, owners of Durham's Coon Rock Farm and Piedmont Restaurant. "When we bought Bella Bean a couple years ago, initially we just wanted to keep it local," says DeMint. "But anyone anywhere can Google and find us. What happened was people all over the country would email and ask us if they could have orders shipped. It felt like the public was asking us to take the next step." Heirloom Provisions carries many of the same products as Bella Beans, except fresh produce. "It doesn't make much sense to ship lettuce out of state," says DeMint. Although the company has only had a soft opening, she's already had a few repeat customers. Some are as far away as Pennsylvania and Iowa, but surprisingly, most of her customers are in the Outer Banks. "I have one lady who once a month is placing giant homemade pasta orders for $150 to $200 just for her family," she says. "Part of the mission is to give small local artisans like Anson Mills retail exposure." Anson Mills is a group of farmers and artisans in South Carolina who bring back ancient and lost grains to the table, such as Carolina gold rice and steel-cut oats and other heirloom grains. Top chefs around the nation are buying from them, but they don't have a retail site. Heirloom Provisions has 20 employees. And in a section called What's Cooking, the headline is, Piedmont in Durham gets a major kitchen overhaul. With only the best in mind for his new workspace, executive chef Ben Adams of Durham-based Piedmont Restaurant spent nearly $20,000 on the kind of equipment generally found in the kitchens of five-star restaurants. Adams, originally from Charleston, South Carolina, has dabbled in a variety of professions, but it was on Wall Street where he saw and tried such a variety of modern dishes that he finally decided to take the plunge and attend culinary school in Portland, Oregon. He's cooked in Belgium, Australia, and his hometown. Some of the equipment was purchased used, but the total spent on the kitchen revamp project equipment alone was $19,800. Among the items purchased were a $4,500 Peco jet for ice creams and purees, and a $6,000 CVAP steam oven. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can of the executive voice section that features Rita Baldwin. The headline, The Orchid Whisperer, How a Former Teacher Turned a Few Flower Pots into a Mega Greenhouse and a Thriving Business. Hidden in the outskirts of Pittsburgh, Rita Baldwin's orchid project began as a hobby before it grew into a business. After retiring from teaching middle school English and craving the humid warmth of her native Florida, Baldwin decided to start growing her beloved orchids for the wholesale market. Beginning with one small greenhouse, she doubled her space in 4 years. Every few years after that, the orchid gallery surged and expanded. While Baldwin has mostly retired from tending to the 10,000-square-foot greenhouse, she still helps her son Jeff, who is taking over the business, along with his wife and two small boys. The 21-year-old business on Hanks Chapel Road may pass down 3 generations. Why did you originally start this business? It was my passion for flowers. I felt there might be a niche market in this area, and as a native Floridian, I thought working in a warm greenhouse was appealing. It was certainly a career change after teaching English in middle school. How did you fund it? I started with one small bay. I had already been growing orchids as a hobby, and when I first started, it was a real learning experience. I was thinking I would just wholesale. I didn't think people would want to come this far out to shop for flowers. Some people wanted me to board orchids, and before I knew it, it grew from there. I do wholesale and retail, but a big part is boarding. Is it your main source of income? And if not, what else do you dabble in? I'm an artist. I have a studio in the barn. I do oil paintings and I sell those too. I'm on the Chatham studio tour. I paint landscapes. I actually don't paint my orchids. I have yet to find an arrangement that I find pleasing. How did you survive the recession? Barely. We cut corners and became more efficient. We used to grow a little bit of everything, but when we cut heating costs, we moved a lot of orchids to the other bay where it was colder. Different species of orchids tolerate lower temperatures. We were also lucky enough to have standing customers we rent orchids to, hotels, businesses. We were able to increase our customer base and we wholesale to Whole Foods, but it's a tough road. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.